654 Real 2.
Just talking about the sniper school that you went to, and you were mentioning that many of them were ghillies from the Highlands.
Yes, most of the instructors in Fieldcraft were ghillies. Lovett Scouts, people like that.
Lovett Scouts?
Yeah, Lovett Scouts. And many of the ghillies became Lovett Scouts and Lovetts.
A Lovett Scout, was that an informal...
Well, it was a TA regiment.
Oh, was it?
Yes, and right. Of course, Lord Lovett was the commander of it, and of course, won the VC at one time. Which, incidentally, again, just recalling, my first company, the battalion, when I joined the 4th Essex, my company commander was... ridiculous.
Well, don't worry, it'll come to you.
Anyway, I mentioned he got the VC at Saint Nazaire. Colonel Newman. He was Major Newman, and he was my company commander.
And
he won the VC at Saint Nazaire.
Which was a raid.
Yes, it was a raid. That was after I had been there. He went to the commandos, and he was a commander at the time.
Right. So you have attended the sniper school. You are really the senior NCO in charge of weapons instruction.
Yeah.
Take me on from there.
Oh, yes. Now, we then went back to Leiston, strangely enough. It was the second time round. Very unusual for that to have happened. My battalion, incidentally, was a part of the 54th East Anglian Division. 5-4 Div, and commanded by Major General John Priestman, and that was a TA division. So we went. So 54 Division moved from the north of England back to East Anglia, and we went back to Leiston, and at that time we were then beginning to carry out much more company and battalion size training exercises, but we were still fairly well under equipped, really, honestly.
Can you give me a date, Jack, roughly when you moved back to
that was in 1941.
So now 1941 you moved back to Leiston.
Yeah, back to Leiston, and there I got very much involved with the Suffolk Home Guard. Now that was a Home Guard more like his dad's army if there ever was one. I can remember one particular occasion. We were teaching them what we call judging distance, how to judge distance over. We took them out on the range, and we had marked out areas where we'd pre-marked out where certain distances were, so we knew exactly what the distance was. And then we had all these chaps and these Home Guard men having to judge the distance from where they were to a particular point that I'd identified for them, and then put it on their backside of their rifle. And I can remember one chap, I said to him, well, how far do you think that is? Well, I can't copy the Suffolk accent well, but it was something like, well, I don't rightly know, he says, but I reckon he'd be about 2 acres. I said, well, you put 2 acres on your backside. But it was a remarkable period. They were terribly enthusiastic and that. We had one or two narrow escapes. I can remember once teaching them grenade throwing. And they had invented the anti-tank grenade. Now, the anti-tank grenade was a thermos flask shape. And you held it in your along your wrist at the top, and had a little cap at the top with a tape. And when you threw it, the tape had a lead weight on it, and it undid, which pulled out the safety pin, so to speak. And then when it hit, it exploded. Well, we used to throw these, or the Home Guard demonstrated them, and then they given the opportunity to throw one of these things. And you had to duck down pretty quick, having thrown it, get Jack back into the slip catch. And on one occasion, I was demonstrating this damn thing, and I stood on the top of the slip trench, and suddenly the ground collapsed, and my foot collapsed underneath me, and I fell with this damn thing in my head. And if it had rolled, it would have blown us all sky high, and I managed to catch it to my chest to stop it going. I must say, from then onwards, I'm not very keen on throwing the thermos flask.
And how well equipped were people now? You've talked about the fact that you started to do proper company and battalion military training.
Reasonably well equipped.
You now are reasonably well equipped.
We had vehicles, and we didn't have any more wooden Bren guns and wooden mortars and things.
And the Suffolk LDV or Home Guard?
Were they
still back with pitchforks?
No. But the Home Guard was largely equipped with. First of all, for rifles, the Home Guard had what was called the P-14. Now, the P-14 was an American rifle which flooded into Britain during the 1940s when the Americans were trying to give us some support. The British Army were equipped with the Enfields. The P-14 was a very accurate rifle, and in fact was used for snipers. Snipers used P-14s. Because I don't even know anything about shooting, but it was capable of what was called a 1-inch group, and that was all the 10 rounds within 1 inch, whereas your Enfield was only capable of a 4-inch group, so all your 10 rounds were within 5 rounds were within a 4-inch area. So the Enfield was not a good rifle for sniping, so the P-14s were. But they had lots of other problems because they had a locking device in the breech, which if you got any dirt or sand in it, wouldn't lock properly. And this was all discovered in World War I. So the Enfield was a much more better rifle, more robust and capable of putting up with conditions. So the Enfield, the P-14, wasn't really issued to the regular army. But the Home Guard almost universally had P-14s, so they had good rifles. They had a number of other very strange things. There was a school set up somewhere in the south of England for developing weapons for the Home Guard, mainly because it was really a home defence, weapons of home defence. There was things like, what was it, the Northover mortar, anyway, I won't go into it in more detail. But there were a number of rather weird weapons, mainly developed by people who had been former communists and fought in the South in the Spanish War. They were quite well known names at the time, you know, publicly they were well known. And they were commissioned into the British Army senior NCOs, and they developed these weapons which the Home Guard universally were provided with. And of course we used to have to know something about them to teach them how to use them.
Of course. Can I just ask this question? In 1940, when the threat of invasion appeared to be very real, the second half of 1940, everybody had broomsticks and your own state of equipment was not as high as perhaps
we would have you had one Bren gun per section. I probably had one Bren gun per platoon at that time. I can't remember. We certainly weren't as well equipped as we subsequently became, but I think we were fairly competent.
And then I was going to ask, 1941, the war in Russia starts. The likelihood of invasion, did you get the feeling that the likelihood of invasion was much less?
Yes.
And therefore I was going to ask, what did the Home Guard then think was their principal function? Was it to take over domestic duties from the regular army and other trainees?
Well, we were never really certain. I suppose we were thinking it was less. Because after all, we hadn't yet reached the point where we were getting some victories overseas. We were still losing the empire. But of course, by the time Alamein came along, and Alamein was the turning point to some extent, but right up to certainly 1942, we had to be alert. There might not still have been an attack. But the Home Guard were very much home defence, whatever. There could have been the odd raid. They're very enthusiastic. I've got a very great respect for them.
Sure, that's my point. Their morale remained high.
They very
were enthusiastic,
high. Yeah.
Notwithstanding that the immediate threat appeared to start to recede, you can get into a mental attitude.
Well, I suppose they became a bit like the pre-war TA. They sort of replaced that. There was a comradeship, and it was something they did on Sunday mornings and occasionally in the evenings. And they continued to provide regularly in certain areas guards on a permanent basis, you know.
Yes.
As a part-time activity. I have a high regard for them.
So now you are a full sergeant. You are in. You have trained Suffolk Farmers. You've also been a very senior NCO in the weapons training section of your battalion. Yeah. Take me on from there, if you...
Well, one other thing I did, it was all probably the background of being weapons, but we started to get the militia, some militiamen who'd been called up, so to speak, into what was called the militia. And my company would get a large number of these, my battalion rather. So we actually created companies, militiamen. And we created training companies. Well, a training company, and this training company at Alborough. I think we had three lots of militia go through that, and I was the acting company sergeant major of that company, training company, based in Alborough. So I had a lot to do with training of the militia that came in.
Right.
Which was quite a useful experience. So it was just myself and a few NCOs that were instructors and the company commander.
Were really the second in command of the battalion?
Well, as the company sergeant major.
You were now CSM, were you?
Well, I was an acting CSM.
Right.
I was only CSM for that company. So when I went back to battalion, I was no longer so.
Right.
You went
back to full sergeant.
Yeah.
Was your rise from private soldier aged 18 and a half when you were mobilized in August of 19 in August of 1939, was your rise from that from private soldier through to acting CSM and a senior and highly trained sergeant within 2 years, was that normal, or would you say that was exceptional? Was it due to this mentor RSM? Who looked after you in a...
Yeah, it probably was normal. I mean, after all, when I subsequently commissioned, we had company commanders at the age of 20 in some places, who were majors. You had Battle of Britain pilots at the age of 18 who were flight lieutenants.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't exceptional. It was probably fairly rapid, and in fact it was, I found it surprising a bit, because at one minute I would be a corporal, and I can remember my platoon commander saying, Corporal Fielder, I've just been told you're going to be a Lance Sergeant. Well, that was about 3 weeks after I'd been made a corporal. So it was pretty rapid in that sense. I think that was the case, and of course I got on very well with the RSM, very well. He knew me, and as weapon training sergeant, I'd be in battalion headquarters, and he'd be at battalion headquarters, and I saw a lot of him. Cut a long story short, he subsequently said, Sergeant Fielder, why don't you become an officer? He recommended me to the CO, and that's how it all started.
And this will be in the summer, autumn of 41?
No, this was, by this time, I've forgotten, I haven't told you. I mean, we actually moved then from Maidstone, we moved to to the Cirencester area.
Did you?
Yes. So we were there for, well, I was there for several months. And it was from there, it was while, I think it was while I was at Cirencester, yes. Yes, I was recommended for a commission by the CO.
And when would that have been, Jack?
That would have been beginning of 42.
Right.
Yeah. That would be. In fact, it didn't work out as well as all that, because I'm an expert on failing commission boards.
And are you?
Yes, I'm an authority on the subject, because I was recommended by the CO, and I went to a commissions board, and I didn't pass at all. I think the CO was pretty livid about this, and he recommended me again.
Livid, not with you, but with the...
Well, he thought I should have been.
Yeah.
Passed the commission board. So he put me up again to go to the commissions board. But meanwhile, I decided that if I was commissioned, I wanted to go to the Indian Army. I wanted to go to the Indian Army, not the British Army.
Why was that?
Well, because the Indian Army were in action and the British Army was stuck in Britain.
Was it true that the Indian Army was better paid?
It didn't really. It was better paid, you're quite right. But that wasn't an issue.
Right.
Payment wasn't the sort of thing.
So they were, because the British Army was in action in North Africa, but you didn't think you could.
No, well,
there.
I'd have gone to India to start with. I'd have been trained in India, joined the Indian Army. And I went on an interview with the India office, and I was accepted to go to the Indian Army. So I'd have been commissioned in the Indian Army, which is what I wanted to do. A little bit of glamour, I suppose, at the time. Anyway, I went to the commissions board a second time and got through with no problem. And then went to a place called Pre-Octu. That was where you go for preparing to go to Octu. 148 Training Brigade, I remember well, down at Rootham. And whilst there, they said to me, well, you're senior NCO, you won't go for a normal octu, you'll go to a very short octu. No, you don't need to start off. Normal octu was about 16 weeks, 4 months, roughly. The short octu was about 7 weeks or something. I said, no, I'm not going to short octu, I'm going to the Indian Army. Oh, so I missed the opportunity to go to the short octu. And I was still waiting for him, to be sent on embarkation leave to go to the Indian Army. And it didn't come, and it didn't come. And I was sitting, training at Rootham, doing what every other pre-octu cadet was doing, because we were cadets there, of course. Lost all our ranks and things. And then I was told all reinforcements to India were suspended because of the amount of shipping that was being sunk on convoys. So you won't be going to the Indian Army. You'll be going to a normal octu. So I lost out. I lost my short octu. I went to 164 octu at Barmouth, which is, as you possibly know, up in Merioneth in North Wales. Pretty tough octu, as well known to be, because it's tough country. All your training was in the mountains all the time.
Yes.
I've been up on the Cadarigerus and things like that, and was in midwinter. The whole time was in winter.
So we're now in the winter of 42-43.
Winter of 42-43, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, and so I went there and missed out on it. We had one advantage of being at Rootham. One of the things we had to be done is be taught to drive and ride a motorcycle properly. I mean, I could drive, but I'd never really ridden a motorcycle. My father was a very keen motorcyclist. I've been on plenty of motorbikes, but I'd never really... And we were taught to ride motorcycles. And this, this has some consequence for me subsequently. And the person that taught me was Stanley Woods. Now, you won't know Stanley Woods, but he was a very famous TT rider. And I was taught, we were all taught, how to ride a motorbike straight down a quarry face, do all sorts of things.
Other side,
yes. And to go off at a tangent for a moment, it is relevant. He did actually, although I've never ridden a motorcycle for pleasure, ever, I've ridden it a lot for sport. That taught me a lot about motorcycling. I actually started with Murray Walker, you know, the commentator, a motorcycle sports club. Myself, he and I started one. And I did a lot of competition riding with him in my time, but subsequently. But only competition.
No, that would have been after the war.
That was immediately after the war. But it all goes back to my time at Rooton, where I was taught by Stanley Woods how to fall off a motorbike at 30 miles an hour without killing yourself. And things like this. And what we did.
Yeah.
Now to ride down a quarry face and up the other side. And now to drive a carrier. You know, tractor carrier and things like that. So I actually learned quite a lot at Rooton about things I wouldn't normally have had access to.
Right.
So that was beneficial. And then I went off to Barmouth, Octave. Well, I did quite well at the Octave. And
you see, this is something
I've
that
got a very high
seems
grade.
To come up from time to a lot. You seem to have, whether it's good fortune or not, I don't know, but after your brief period as a furrier, and then another job that occupied you between that and joining the army, you seem to have found your niche. Because you accelerated very quickly. You were very good at training the LDV in Sunderland and Suffolk, and you were quickly rising through the ranks of the NCOs until you become a very senior weapons instructor, and you were drilling 500 Suffolk rustics or whatever, and now you, apart from the slight blip of your first commission board, you very rapidly find your métier, haven't you?
Mm.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Can I go back and tell you another Home Guard story? Because I think this is relevant.
Please.
When I was when we were in Cirencester, I then again the Gloucester Home Guard, and it was a funny place. This really was. I can remember going to my first time I went to them. I can remember. This bunch of elderly gentlemen. I was teaching them grenade throwing. And there was this funny old chap in a First World War officer's uniform with his rank on his sleeve down here and a lance corporal stripe up here. And anyway, I was teaching him grenade throwing. And I thought, well, I don't know, these chaps were throwing grenades at the Somme. What am I doing teaching them? But they lapped it all up. And on this first night, bearing in mind, I mean, this is relevant, my pay as a sergeant those days, because we started off with 14 shillings a week, two bob a day.
As a private soldier?
As a private soldier. But my pay as a sergeant was about £2.5 or something like that a week. So much a day, actually, wasn't on a weekly basis. I can't remember.
£2, five shillings.
So it would work out about £2.5 a week, I suppose. Certainly not very much, but it seemed a lot of money in those days. It was a lot of money. I mean, as a sergeant I was very well off. I mean, £2, very good money when you think the average wage in Britain before the war was only just over £2.10 a week.
I was going to
so you know, it was good pay in that sense. However, going back to the Home Guard, at the end of this first night change session, thank you very much, sergeant, have a drink. And he, I said, no, of course not. You know, no, you mustn't pay me anything. No, this is my job. Oh, and he thrust four coins in my head. Now, I remember thinking, oh, fourpence. Well, fourpence is fourpence, and we bought a pint of beer, and he's absolutely right, put it in my pocket. But it wasn't. It was four half crowns, 10 shillings. That's a lot of money. Every time I turned that hand, I used to pass the hat round. I was getting more than I was actually earning as a sergeant. And it was completely illegal. They shouldn't have done it. But, I mean, you couldn't stop them. Their morale was very high, and they loved it. And this young sergeant coming to teach his old boys, that they'd forgotten a bit about, of course, what the First World War was about anyway. But anyway, I enjoyed teaching them.
Good.
So So anyway, that goes back to Octu, and I went to, as I said, 164 Octu in Barmouth.
Where you did well.
Yes, I passed that quite highly. Yeah. And so
can you tell me something about the other people? We're now in the middle of the war. What were the other people on that Octu like? Was it a great mishmash, a great polyglot?
Yeah, there was a whole range of people, experiences and things. Many of them were quite young. Many of them were younger than me and possibly were former privates and lance corporals.
Yeah.
But only recently left school, relatively well educated. Many of them were graduates. I always remember among them, one of them, a chap called David Flower, who was reading English literature. He was obviously a poet of some quality. But he was also an expert in jiu-jitsu, which is, in those days,
was almost unheard of.
Yeah, he had the black belt or whatever, you know, the appropriate belts were. And we had a rather unpleasant physical training instructor. And he picked on Flower once. He didn't realise what he could do, and we were teaching unarmed combat. And suddenly this physical training instructor did a curve, he was thrown miles. But he was livid about this, and he said, "Why did you do that to me?" And he said, "Well, you were going to hurt me." He didn't realise what David Flower was. And, he was a very popular man. But he was typical of the sort of young people that most in the First World War and the Second World War, who were a highly educated background with another literature, and it showed, you know.
Yes.
But he was one of many that. I was commissioned from. I was commissioned in January 1943. It so happened that I applied to go back to my regiment, the Essex Regiment, commissioned in the Essex Regiment. It so happened, and I never mentioned this, when I went to be commissioned from my battalion, there were five of us went from the battalion at the same time, including one chap.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop again. Jack, we've got as far as January 43. You are at your Octu. And I think I asked you about the varied people who you would have met there. Can you just tell me a little bit more about them, if you can? The sort of people who you would have met at that stage in the war.
The particular point I wanted to make was that there were five of us went from my battalion to that Octu. And we all put down to go to the Essex Regiment, back to the regiment. We were all commissioned into the same regiment and joined the same battalion, the Dorset Regiment.
Right.
None of us went to the Essex. We all went to the battalion that I subsequently ended up with. And we at the time, we laughed very slightly, and were amused, the fact that, of course, the Dorset Regiment badge is very similar to the Essex Regiment badge, because it's got the castle in the middle, and of course, in Essex is the castle of Gibraltar. As far as the Dorset Regiment was concerned, it was the keep, the Dorchester. But he looked the same. So he said, "Well, at least we got the same cap badge." And we were all bitterly disappointed and protested very strongly about going to the Dorset Regiment, who we'd hardly ever heard of or anything else, you see.
Was this normal, to be posted all over the place?
Yes, you very rarely got the regiment you wanted. You went to the regiment that needed officers at the time. That was it. Mind you, on reflection, of course, I never regretted it, of course. And looking back, I mean, I have a deep love for the regiment and a deep love for the county of Dorset as a consequence, because it was another TA battalion, apart from anything else. I went to the 5th Dorset, which was a TA battalion. And I arrived there as a second lieutenant on the round about the 30th of January, in 1943. They took one look at my record. I became a platoon commander, but within weeks I became the weapon training officer of the battalion. The whole of the time we were in England, which was until D-Day, we were down, at that time, we were down in Kent. In the sort of Dover area, and then we ended up in Hastings, where we actually went to Normandy from. But in that period, I was platoon commander. I eventually became second in command of company second in command as a lieutenant, not as a captain, because the second in command are all captains. But my CO used the captain's ranks for all the specialist officers and took them away from the companies. So all our companies were had subalterns as their second in commands.